dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody
tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we continue our series into the mental conditioning that underlies and perpetuates the type of society we have, one in which most people are frustrated and depressed, in spite of being repeatedly told that this is the best of all possible worlds. In a speech given by Professor Noam Chomsky at the University of Illinois in September that you may have heard broadcast on Democracy Now!, he noted the extent to which absurd statements and transparent lies uttered by George Bush and other top officials went largely unchallenged by intellectuals as well as the media. This highly educated class of people were somehow able to repeat, as well as discuss, these farcically false official claims without even a snicker. This ability to subordinate one's intelligence and creativity to reflect the values and serve the needs of the small group at the top of the social pyramid is the special skill that marks the professional in our society, according to Jeff Schmidt, who has written an amazing book, Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives. In our second hour, I'm going to begin a series of readings from the book, which I'll continue over the coming weeks as I think it illuminates the indoctrination that shapes the class of people who are the linchpin of this society. We'll begin the program, though, with a look at another vector of social control directed at those at the bottom of the pyramid, the criminal justice system, and the mindset that has made the United States number one in jailing its citizens.
I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good, and I'm friendly to strangers.
Professor of Law and Sociology David Garland of New York University is the author of a new book, The Culture of Control. He spoke at the University of Wisconsin at Madison on October 8th.
Anyway, what I want to do is outline the argument of my most recent book, The Culture of Control, which is essentially an attempt to write a history of the present of the field of crime control and criminal justice. Anyone who reads the newspapers today is aware that in the USA there are lots of people in prison and in jail. 2 million is the daily average that's now been reached. But what people don't always know is, first of all, how much of a change this is from past practice, particularly in the period up to 1970. Nor do they know the extent to which the change in imprisonment, which is kind of like the headline figure and the headline issue, is only one index or only one kind of element of a much broader and extensive transformation that's occurred in the world of crime control and criminal justice over the last 30 years. And really, the book is an attempt to map out these changes and also to offer a sociological explanation of how it is that they came about in the form and in the places that they did. So the first notion is that since about, say, 1970, an enormous amount has changed in this particular domain of institutional and social life. In fact, if a criminologist were to have fallen asleep back then and woken up after 30 years of snoozing, they'd be utterly shocked by what it is that they were to find all around them. The whole landscape's completely changed. So there are 2 million people in prison and in jail, 4.6 million people on probation and parole. Back in 1970, there was between, depending on whether you count jails or prisons, between a sixth and a quarter that number of people. Similarly, the death penalty is up and running as an institution. 70 to 80 people being put to death every year. Back in 1970, there had been no executions for 3 or 4 years, and the beginning of the constitutional abolition of the death penalty was very much on the cards. Victim impact statements and victims' rights language in, I think now, 29 state constitutions was completely unheard of. Nobody imagined that that would be a characteristic of criminal justice. Sentencing law, for any of you who know the law of sentencing, has been completely revolutionised. In 1970, every state in the nation and the federal government had what are described as indeterminate sentencing laws. Basically laws that were passed sentences that were open-ended so that the decision as to when to release would be made by prison officials and parole boards and adult authorities and so on. These, by and large, have been completely changed so that most states now have mandatory sentences. Every state has some mandatory sentences. Half of them have fixed sentences. A dozen of them abolish parole. If somebody was interested in juvenile offenders, they'd be shocked to find that nowadays so many of them are being waived up to adult courts and sentenced to adult time. If people were thinking about prisons, they certainly would have imagined that prisons would be privatised now as well as publicly run. A whole bunch of unimaginable things going on. In fact, if the person were to take care not to look at what's happening all the time and how people are being processed, but also at some of the legislative gestures and efforts by particular states to make an impact on the question of punishment, they would notice that there are now actually chain gangs reintroduced in the South, and corporal punishment has been reintroduced and discussed in half a dozen legislatures. At this point, the criminologists would think that actually they were still asleep and they must be dreaming. It couldn't possibly be the case that that's been happening, but it has. So what the book, The Culture of Control, tries to do is, first of all, to document these transformations and then to offer a kind of explanation of how they came about. And in order to identify what I think of as being the underlying structural circumstances, the underlying social changes that have produced new kinds of risks and insecurities, new kind of situations, which form a kind of social surface on which these crime control changes have been built. What I deliberately did in the book was to study both the USA and United Kingdom. And by doing so, I deliberately kind of abstracted away from the particulars of the political history of both of these places in this period, so that some of the things that you would expect to be most prominent in an account of, you know, changing crime control and punishment, things like, in the USA, race relations or handguns or crack cocaine or federalism or the war on drugs or the Southern strategy, these things are in the book, but they're kind of treated as if they were proximate causes and exacerbating circumstances rather than the underlying motor of change. In the same way that if you're interested in Britain, you would expect to see, you know, class divisions and immigration and Mrs. Thatcher featuring very prominently, again, they're kind of further back in the mix. Because the effort is really to identify what turns out to be common to both of these nations, despite their very different political histories and political complexions. Now, of course, that interest, if that claim about structural underpinnings, or at least structural conditions prompting the possibility of these changes, if that claim is true, then it raises a very interesting question about other nations in which very similar social changes have occurred, very similar, as it were, restructuring of everyday life has occurred in the post-war period from about 1950 onwards. The question for them is whether the same sorts of structural changes have prompted the same kind of criminological adaptations and crime control adaptations in these settings. And in fact, a number of colleagues in Belgium and in France have embarked on a three-nation study to try and, as it were, identify precisely these questions and see how they hold up in these different circumstances. So, the idea of the book is to look at this rather broad range of institutions and practices, all the way from not just criminal justice in the sense of police and courts and prisons, but also crime prevention and the behaviour of households and victims and communities in the face of crime. The idea is to try and look at these different behaviours broadly, looking at the field as a whole. When one does this, and particularly when one does this and examines both the USA and the UK, a number of findings, as it were, come into view that wouldn't have otherwise been apparent, and which are really quite surprising. So, four of these. The first finding is just the one I've already indicated, that the measures that are now established in criminal justice and crime control, which we take for granted, were by and large completely unpredicted, unexpected, and would be shocking to anyone standing in 1970 and looking forward. This is not the future that was predicted back then. In fact, 1970 was really the end point, although it didn't seem like that at the time, of a much longer period of development, what I describe as the kind of period of penal welfareism, the period of progressive, welfare state-oriented, rationalized penal change that really you can date from the 1890s onwards. 1970 looked as if that was continuing. In fact, many of these developments were utterly reversed. Second thing that becomes apparent when you look at the field as a whole in this way is that the developments that have occurred are not reducible to any singular logic or singular process. So, for example, Jonathan Simon and Malcolm Feely have talked about the emergence of a kind of new penology, a risk management actuarial style of justice. And it's true that that really has emerged, but it's emerged alongside its opposite, a kind of rather archaic penology of vengeance and vindication. There's more punishment, obviously. There's a larger punitive state, but at the same time, there's also much more prevention and preventative activity. There's a much bigger criminal justice state, but actually that state is now much more acutely aware of its limitations and acts much more extensively to overcome these limitations by invoking action on the part of other agencies than was ever previously the case. There have been changes in the state's response to crime, but actually the biggest change, I think, has been the shifting place of crime in the culture of our daily lives, in the character of the built environment, and indeed in our imagination. So that in a sense it's not just a political shift or an institutional one, there's been a shift in the way crime figures for us as we lead our lives on a daily basis. And finally, there's no relationship of a direct kind, although I want to suggest there is an indirect form of relationship, between crime rates and penal responses, either in terms of timing or in terms of correlation state by state between crime and punishment. The third thing that comes into view when the field is regarded from this kind of distance is that changes that have occurred look remarkably similar on both sides of the Atlantic. The UK and the USA, despite all of their differences, exhibit precisely the same kind of shifting orientation, the same kind of new strategies, the same kind of policy formation, the same developments, indeed the same sensibilities and values coming into play. Now, of course, I know you probably will gather I'm not American by origin, I'm actually from Scotland, and I know the UK very well. There are major differences of intensity and extent of punishment there as compared with here. I don't ignore that. I discussed this in the book, and in fact yesterday in the lecture in the law school, that was kind of the first of the Havens lectures, I discussed reasons for the different intensity and different extent of the politics of punishing in this country. But despite these, as it were, differences of scale, what's really striking is the extent to which the US and the UK have walked more or less lockstep in crime control policy in the last 30 years, and in a way that was, as it were, unexpected in both places. And finally, I just throw this out. I won't discuss it much today at all. The changes that have occurred in criminal justice over the last 30 years have strikingly similar analogues in the field of social policy and welfare. In other words, if one turns away from how the state deals with deviance or how people respond to crime and look instead at how claimants for welfare benefits are treated, then many of the same considerations and the same concerns kind of find very vivid enactment there. So the reaction against welfareism, the critique of perverse incentives, the new emphasis on deterrence and on discipline, and actually also the attempt to require the client, just like the prison inmate, to kind of take responsibility for their own rehabilitation or their own reintegration into the labour market. These things really have very stark parallels in both places.
Okay, so transformation, extensive, unexpected, and in some sense shared in different kinds of places. The first chapter of the book documents in some detail the way things have changed over these 30 years. And I really won't go through that right now because in a sense it's it would take me too much time, and also I want to get to the sociological explanation of change rather than the details of what exactly has been transformed. But let me just make sure you have in mind, and I don't know how many of you really know criminal justice or criminology at all well, let me just kind of give you headline items. First of all, that the notion, always kind of more of an orthodoxy of principle than actually of practice, but the notion of rehabilitation has been completely transformed in that period. It's not that rehabilitation has disappeared. It's not as if there are no treatment programs in our prisons or on probation. Rather, rehabilitation has kind of become one element in the management of risk. It used to be the other way around. You used to have sort of rehabilitative programs in which risk featured as an issue. You couldn't release people when they were still a risk to the public. Now it's the other way around. The key thing is the management of risk, and rehabilitation is one way, not of, as it were, rescuing the offender, but of saving future victims if the particular rehabilitative program will work. Similarly, and kind of part of the same story, there's been a shift in the character of crime policy. First of all, as I mentioned before, victims have come to stand front and center of crime policy and criminal justice activity. In fact, virtually everything today has to be justified in terms of benefits to victims. And they're seen as a kind of zero-sum game between, as it were, concern for the offender and concern for the victim. It's in a way a kind of backlash that people, I think, by the 1970s came to the view that the whole rehabilitative ethos, the correctionist ethos, despite the fact that it was supposed to reduce crime, had been given much too exquisite concern to the needs of the offender, supposedly, and not at all concerned itself with the needs of the victim. Of course, that axis has completely shifted, so that now everything has to be justified in the name of, sometimes literally in the name of, victims. Jenna's Law, Megan's Law, or Sarah's Law are examples of that. At the same time, the way that the criminal justice system is run is strikingly different. There's been a repoliticization of what had previously been a more or less professionalized domain. What I mean by that is that the extent to which decision making has been delegated to criminal justice officials has really been limited. Politicians, legislatures, usually through sentencing law, like mandatory sentences or fixed sentences, have taken control of fixing the punishment that will be imposed on the offender, and doing it, as it were, well in advance of the particular crime. That's what mandatory sentences are all about. Judicial discretion has been minimized, and the capacity of criminal justice personnel to decide who goes in, who goes out, who's released, when and how, that capacity has been extensively restricted. It's as if, and I think it is the case, that the public and certainly their political representatives now refuse to extend any trust to criminal justice professionals. It's always as if the criminal justice machine is continually generating risk, continually endangering the public, and it has to be controlled. Hence the kind of the political controls imposed there. And at the same time, the trust and the credibility and the power extended to professionals, criminal justice professionals, criminological researchers, people who know about the impact of certain crimes and their likely costs and their likely benefits, that's really been greatly reduced in this period. There's a new kind of populism. So what counts is what the public wants rather than what the experts tell us will work. And that's really been dismaying for many of the people in the system, not least judges and prison governors and probation staff who have to deal with the fallout from this. In the 1970s, in the 1960s, you might have looked at the behaviour of the Warren Court or the extension of civil rights and civil liberties and even prisoners' rights, which were just flourishing briefly at that time. And you would have noticed that, you know, there's a concern to protect individuals from the might of the state, from, as it were, the overreach of state power. Ever since then, the concern has been not protection from the state, but protection by the state. There's the sense that, above all, the public has to be protected from the threat of crime and violence and disorder, and whatever the state has to do is pretty much acceptable. Anyone who represents a risk has to be managed, and the fact that they have liberty interests seemed much less of a concern to anyone. As in part consequence of that, the prison has been reinvented. In 1970, I think it's fair to say that most people who knew anything about corrections regarded the prison as a kind of a failed and discredited correctional institution that would henceforth be utilised only in these minimal cases where no other alternative would operate effectively. Instead, the opposite happened. The prison has been reinvented as a kind of indispensable mechanism of exclusion and incapacitation and retribution. The prison has really taken off in this new setup. And finally, one of the things that's often disregarded in this kind of litany of what's happened and how things have all gotten worse is there's been, over the last 30 years, usually at the level of local authorities and usually in ways that are intimately connected to private initiatives and business initiatives, there's been the build-up of a kind of infrastructure of preventative action to do with crime control and to do with order maintenance. And that often takes the form of business improvement districts or public-private partnerships. Sometimes it's neighbourhood watch, sometimes it's community policing, projects for safer cities and so on. That kind of development that responds to crime, not through punishment, but instead through designing crime out, channeling crime away, minimising the opportunities for crime, situational crime prevention, these things have really built up in the last few decades. And they're really the only new institution that's occurred. In fact, what I conclude at the end of this kind of descriptive account is that it's not as if the institutional landscape has changed. There's still the same institutions in criminal justice operating, with the exception of this, as it were, crime prevention network. Rather, the institutions are now motivated by and oriented towards values and priorities and a kind of sensibility that's really quite different from before. Hence this notion of a culture of control, which I think both drives the criminal justice response, the primary concern is to manage risk, to impose control, to ensure public safety, and also, as I'll suggest, has a much broader, more extensive resonance in terms of how it is that people lead their lives on a daily basis in any case. Nothing to do with controlling deviance, everything to do with, as it were, building into their own routines patterns of avoidance, patterns of safety, patterns of control. So, that's the descriptive account, very rapidly, as it were, telegrammed to you. The question then becomes, of course, what brings this transformation about? What's the explanation for this extensive and unexpected change? And in outlining the account, I'm sort of responding in a way to what's the standard conventional wisdom about what's happened. Put very broadly, most of the time when people discuss this, and of course it's typically people who are critical of the developments who do discuss this, the finger is pointed at populist politicians, reactionary politicians, and maybe also the rabble-rousing of the popular media and the tabloid press. And they are, as it were, attributed causal efficacy in bringing this about, as if, in a way, they're acting autonomously, as if they're kind of rabble-rousing and bringing public opinion behind them for the purposes of doing something that the public actually doesn't really care about, but now kind of gets anxious about when it's led by the politicians to have that view. And of course there's some truth in this. It's certainly the case that media and political representations are the kind of proximate and dispositive causes of new legislation, new policy and so on. But the claim that I make, or at least the position I move from in the book, is that politicians, the political class, cannot, as it were, invoke a law and order politics with success anytime, anywhere they like. First of all, law and order politics of this kind aren't a standard feature of either the USA or the UK over the last century. They appear at a particular time, particular places, for particular reasons. Secondly, these politics are, as it were, They depend in a variety of ways on public support, which is not free of charge. The kinds of prison building program, the kind of development of penal powers and policing powers that I've just been describing, do not come cost-free to the public, either to the taxpayer, who's, as it were, in one state after the other, actually being asked to make allocations between budgetary headings, and quite often ends up, as it were, supporting building of new prisons or the expansion of the new prison population at the cost and the understood cost of, say, educational cuts or cuts in other social services. So this doesn't come free, nor is it free to citizens in the sense that the increasing state powers and police powers and the increasing, as it were, control on daily life and restriction on daily life is a major irritation and a major loss of liberty and civil rights. These are not things that people just go, fine, take it away, you do this, it sounds like a terrible problem, you should fix it. The reason I'm suggesting that politicians find these to be successful political gestures and strategies is precisely because they do resonate with something that people, extensive groups of the population, find matter to them on a daily basis. And in fact, that's one reason why it's not just that we have, as it were, a huge carceral archipelago of people locked up. We also have, you know, kind of fortified living for the upper middle classes as well. We have gated communities. We have, you know, fortified dwelling places. So it's not just the kind of gesture that's unrelated to how it is that people live their lives. So the explanation that I offer, and this is kind of very broad brush as presented here. It's rather better documented, of course, in the book, but it's still pitched at a rather general level. The explanation for why this transformation comes about identifies two major historical forces. One of them quite general, and the other more specific to the USA and the UK. The very general one is a whole series of social and economic and cultural changes from the 1950s really through to the 1970s that I describe as the coming of late modernity. That's just like a tag, really talking about the modernizing changes that occurred in the last part of the 20th century. And that's the general, as it were, social force that's operative. The more contingent one has to do with the emergence in the US and the UK of a politics that combines neoliberalism and neoconservatism, a politics that combines moral disciplines and market disciplines, and which has emerged specifically since the late 1970s, early 1980s, in a way of, as it were, adapting to and handling and managing and thematizing many of these changes and many of the risks that they brought about. So what I mean by the coming of late modernity and how on earth does it have any impact on crime and crime control and punishment? Well, the lengthy chapter there was like a summary of, as it were, social change and social stratification shifts in the last three decades. And this is the wrong place for someone to try and summarize that in 2 minutes. But essentially, the kind of headlines have to do with, first of all, after 1950s, the coming of what's essentially a consumer society, the decades of relatively full employment, the decades of increasing standards of living and consumption, the circulation of large numbers of consumer durables, the invention of and the circulation of cars and automobiles and commodities of that kind. And then, of course, from the 1970s onwards, the transformation of the economy in a way that rendered it much less secure, that transformed the labour market, dualised the labour market, made it more precarious, deindustrialised, as it were, producing a consumer society which large sections of the population are, as it were, excluded from despite its operation. Secondly, during this period, and very important for crime and crime vulnerabilities, is the transformation of families and households. The movement of married women and mothers into the workforce, the high rates of divorce, the low density households, the two parent two income family, all of which actually transforms how households look and where they're vulnerable and who's at home looking after them. Thirdly, changes in the basic social ecology, the coming of the automobile, the coming of the highway, the coming of the suburb, spreading out social life,
as it were, transforming the way in which time and place and people are put together, and rendering the landscape that much more vulnerable to criminal events of various kinds. A bunch of other things too, including, as it were, the development of the mass media and television, transforming, as it were, the national into the local, particularly with regard to stories like crime. The development of democratization, you know, many of these things, very positive progressive changes, desubordination in the sense of the weakening of rank and authority structures, not necessarily transformation of power positions, but the weakening of automatic respect for authority and so on. And by and large, the kind of the loosening of the grip that traditions and groups and places have over individuals. Now, the consequence of these extensive and familiar and large impact social changes for crime and for insecurity are really vivid and really important. One of the things that one of the largest recurring social facts of the second half of the 20th century is the extent to which crime rates, recorded crime rates, and once they were available, victim survey recorded rates too, crime rates from the 1950s and particularly the 1960s onwards suddenly, steeply increase in all categories of crime. And this is true of every developed nation, with the singular exception of Japan, which I learn is actually experiencing its own, as it were, increased vulnerability and insecurity just in this last decade. High crime rates between 1960 and 1990 become a normal social fact. And this increase of violence and the increase of property crime, particularly an increase in, as it were, disorder and insecurity, all of these things look perfectly intelligible in retrospect. I mean, at the time, it was always a kind of bewildering what on earth's going on. We expected affluence to, and education and welfare to, as it were, dampen down the problem of crime and reform individuals and make crime much less likely. How come all these good things have brought all this crime? Well, in retrospect, if you think about it, these developments in the second half of the 20th century brought about, first of all, the circulation of masses of consumer goods, not just TVs and stereos and hi-fis and computers, but particularly things like cars. Theft of and theft from cars turned out to be the largest single item in the larceny counts. That wasn't available, as it were, in the period prior to the 1940s, 1930s. Secondly, during that period of time, there's been the relaxation of social and situational controls for reasons that I've just described. Both parents at work, suburban households empty, self-service shops, downtown areas depopulated at nights. And thirdly, along with, as it were, more goods and opportunities and less control in the situations, there's been an increased supply in that period of what you might think of as likely offenders or at-risk individuals, in particular, young teenage males, more mobile, more affluent, and less closely supervised, either by family or by work in this period, all of which amounts to a standard recipe for a crime harvest, and that's precisely what every nation gets in this period. Now, while crime rates and violence rates are developing, and here it's not just an artifact of statistics. I mean, in between 1950 and 1990 in the USA, the homicide rate, which of all the, as it were, crime counts is the one that's hardest to fabricate, that doubles. In the UK, robbery rates, which actually are more often reported than not, although of course there's a reporting bias, they actually increased between 1950 and 1990 by a factor of 49. That's to say 49 times as many robberies occur in Great Britain in 1990 as occurred in 1950. The crime rate as a whole multiplies by a factor of 10 during that period of time. You know, this is not an artifact of recording or reporting, although there's some of that. This is a massive social fact that people experience and presents, as it were, real everyday problems for both the agencies that are dealing with it and also the individuals who are victimized by it. And what I think's happened, in fact, is that this, as it were, this new social fact, this the normality of high rates of crime, for a period of time in the 60s and 70s, the old recipes, the correctionalist style, the policing and prosecution styles that had been up and running for decades before, as it were, are used and used again and continue to be used until eventually it's apparent that they're just not working and that, as it were, there needs to be some rethinking, some reinvention, some new adaptations to this problem. And interestingly, the adaptations and inventions that happen are not just by state officials, not just by the institutions that are charged with the job of controlling crime, because, of course, it's clear that they're failing to do that job very effectively. And while they're failing it, individuals and households and communities, and let's not forget corporations, are being victimized by this increased level of activity. And so civil society begins to adapt as well. And in fact, what I do in the book is I tell two distinct stories. I mean, they're interlocked, and I'll talk about the ways in which they interact right at the end. But I tell two distinct stories about how, on the one hand, the state and its criminal justice agencies have adapted to, or indeed reacted against, this new situation. But also I tell the story of how agents and actors of civil society have, in their daily life, in their ways of living, in their habits and routines, how they've come to terms with life in a crime-prone society. And, of course, how they come to terms with it is actually, as it were, to some extent, variable, not just between different kinds of groups, and, you know, urban and inner city and suburban and rural and so on, but actually there's a kind of psychological dynamic and ambivalence there which is really quite interesting. On the one hand, I think, there's a sort of stoical, let's get used to it, let's do what we have to do, let's just, as it were, get on with life in ways that avoid these problems, in the same way that we've gotten used to traffic and the danger and the irritation that, as it were, the modern traffic system offers to all of us. We kind of go, well, you don't kind of think this is a terrible thing, we should do without it. We just kind of adapt our routines to, as it were, handle and manage the problem. So there's that kind of stoical, rather rational, rather, as it were, creative set of adaptations. But there's also, when it comes to crime, maybe not when it comes to traffic, a level of irritation and aggravation and anger and resentment which swells up not just, as it were, in the face of terrible, heinous crimes. They always occurred, but they usually occurred to other people, usually poor people, usually not the people who matter, as it were, to the electorate, who really have an impact on policy. But crime is something that begins to be happening to even those privileged classes. Now, they're not, as it were, the victims of muggings and rapes and murders most of the time, but they are the victims of burglaries, and they are the victims of theft of and from their cars. And everybody knows this, and everybody pays the insurance for this. And everybody's involved in this on a daily basis. And indeed, everyone's patterns of life are that much more expensive and that much more complicated and that much more irritated precisely because of this new social fact. And it's quite difficult to, as it were, disentangle the minor criminality to which you're actually exposed from the major risks of serious criminality that you read about in the newspapers, particularly when, you know, your home security consultant comes around and explains to you that you don't need a burglar alarm, sir, you need an intruder alarm, because you have to worry not just about people stealing stuff when you're away during the day, but kind of pushing in and raping your wife and murdering you and your children. My God, how could that be true? But in a way, it isn't true, but we worry that it is. And that kind of new level of involvement and adaptation, I think, has become much more general amongst groups of the population who previously were not, as it were, anxious, not worried, not involved in crime and punishment. And I think that gives rise to a certain kind of punitiveness, a certain kind of support for or refusal to obstruct the development of policies which these same liberal elites and professional middle classes would once upon a time have really found obnoxious and unacceptable. I saw there was a clock somewhere. Mm-hmm. Kind of,
it's quarter after four.
Okay. Let me do this very rapidly. I want to just tell these the headlines of these two stories. So first of all, the state actors. And here I go through, as it were, all the different agencies and organizations of criminal justice and discuss them. But essentially, here's the predicament that most of the criminal justice agencies faced increasingly vividly and in a self-conscious way from the 1970s onwards. That first of all, there was the fact that high rates of crime had become a normal social fact. They weren't going away. It wasn't getting better. It was getting worse year by year. Secondly, the criminal justice system is and was clearly limited in its effectiveness. One of the startling findings that criminologists in the Home Office made very early on was that all the offences that are known to occur in the nation in any one year, out of every 100 of these known offences, only 3 of them end up being the subject for criminal process. That's to say, only 3 of them actually get to the stage of being in the criminal justice system. And of these, 1/3 of them actually don't get any further than a caution by the arresting police officer. So only 2 out of 100 end up being processed. And of these, only a small number actually end up being imprisoned. So there's the sense of all the crime that's going on, all the offences that are being committed, the criminal justice is grasping a tiny proportion of these. Now, it might succeed in grasping, as it were, the repeat offenders or the likely suspects, but by and large, if you're worried about crime, you know criminal justice is not the solution to the problem. It just doesn't grip the problem directly. So there's this sense of high crime is a normal social fact, limited effectiveness, understood limited effectiveness by criminal justice agencies, but also the problem that, you know, the state can't be seen to, as it were, give up this responsibility, to disown this, as it were, sovereign claim, to deny its monopoly on the delivery of security. You know, after all, the state and the criminal justice system in particular has for the longest time claimed that it has, as it were, the responsibility and the duty and the expertise to deliver security and control crime. It's a job for the professionals. It's something we do. To suddenly discover that actually it's not something we can do at all presents a political problem. You have to step back from the expectation that this will be done, and at the same time deal with the political difficulty of doing that precisely when people are worried about crime. They don't want to be told that the government can do less than you think. So you have this kind of predicament, how to handle this new acknowledged difficulty. And what we see, and it kind of varies over time and over place, but what we see is a whole series of adaptations and responses. The first, in the 1960s, 1970s, is all about professionalising the police force, improving technology, adding in computers, getting better information. When that doesn't work, you begin to see the redefining of what success and failure really is. So it's no longer a matter of you should judge the police and judge the prisons in terms of how crime is reduced or how inmates are reformed. Instead, you should just judge the organisations in terms of, you know, how fast they deliver the service, or, you know, how quickly a police officer gets to the scene of the crime, or how many inmates are kind of put through, or what the costs of the enterprise are. So it's all about kind of outputs rather than outcomes from that point on. Similarly, the criminal justice system starts addressing consequences rather than causes. So maybe we can't control crime, but we can begin to control fear of crime. Or we can begin to reduce the costs of crime. Or maybe we can begin to, as it were, support the victims of crime. There are things that can be done short of dealing with the crimes themselves, and maybe shifting our attention to them would make some sense. Another early and important response was what I describe in the words of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who actually meant something very different by it, as defining deviance down. One of the things that the criminal justice agencies begin to do is, in the 1970s and 1980s, raise the threshold of attention of criminal justice so that lots of misdemeanors that would previously be dealt with are no longer dealt with. Individuals who are first-timers will be cautioned rather than charged. Individuals who used to be sent to probation or to prison are fined rather than locked up. That's the first phase of handling this. You kind of, basically, let's focus on the serious stuff. Let's conserve our resources and target our resources. Let's not deal with, you know, the nuisance stuff, the low-level stuff, the first offenders, the nuisance offenders, and so on. Now, of course, what one sees, and particularly in New York City, where I now live, and particularly with James Q. Wilson and George Kelling's thesis of Broken Windows, is a sudden reaction and backlash against that in the 1990s. People begin to say, look, it's precisely because we've been ignoring misdemeanors, and precisely because we've been, as it were, giving people too many let-offs, that we have the crime problems that we do. Therefore, the kind of the quality of life zero-tolerance policing of the 1990s is all about reversing that earlier policy of defining deviance down. And by the way, the public didn't much like being, as it were, having its deviance defined out of importance. If you find that you've been broken into and they don't bother sending any investigators around to fingerprint, if you find that your car's been stolen and they treat it like an insurance claim rather than a theft, if you find that, you know, there's some kind of minor assault but because nobody's carrying a gun, no police officer is going to show up, there's a sense that the service isn't being provided the way it should. So defining deviance down is one of these kind of time-limited policies. But the other thing that the government does is begin to try and shift responsibility. You get a whole series of police commissioners and chiefs of police talking in a very explicit way about how the police can't deliver this by themselves. Victims and households and neighbourhoods have to get in on the act, have to, as it were, take responsibility for crime control too. A whole bunch of attempts to, what I describe as, kind of responsibilize non-state actors, to get them involved, to get them to take responsibility for the consequences of their own criminal acts. So it's like a polluters pays principle starts up. You see shopping malls and football stadiums and large-scale events where criminal events are generated by these spaces and these places and these events. Why should the police have to, as it were, police them? Why shouldn't it be done privately? Why shouldn't they have to pay? Why shouldn't they get to take responsibility? And at one time, the Home Office was thinking of requiring large-scale retailers to pay for the prosecution of shoplifters on the basis that, you know, they're producing the shoplifting. Why should the state and the taxpayer have to foot the bill? So you get all these adaptations, which are, as it were, more or less rational, more or less, as it were, based on information. You also get what I describe in a deliberately provocative kind of language of psychoanalysis. You get denial and acting out responses. Denial that is really a sense of, you know, the predicament I just described is simply made to disappear. Two good examples of denial are the prison works policy. In the UK, there was a startling example of denial when, in 1993, Michael Howard, who was the Home Secretary appointed in that year, picked up the reins of prison policy, which had previously been described as the government's commitment is, this was a Conservative government, this was Mrs. Thatcher's government as it happened, had been up until that time committed to reducing the use of imprisonment because it was, quote, to use the Prime Minister's own words, an expensive way of making bad people worse. That was what prison was about, that's why we should use less of it. The next year, actually several months later, the new Home Secretary, Michael Howard, says, forget that, prison works. Prison deters, prison incapacitates, prison punishes. We will no longer judge policy a success if it reduces the prison population. We will instead provide as much prison as is needed to sentence offenders to what it is they deserve. And at that point, the prison population, it's 1993, in the UK took off, and it hasn't stopped since. Its rate of incline is actually steeper and faster than that of the USA over the last 30 years. Similarly, you have a whole series of policies that are kind of acting out. That's to say, policies that are all about being expressive, all about doing something for the sake of doing something, and often concealing the underlying problem, the underlying conflict. Things like all the mandatory sentencing laws, things like three strikes and you're out, things like the Sexually Violent Predator Act, things like Megan's Law and chain gangs, and indeed the death penalty when it's used. All of these things, in large part, have no plausible crime control motivation. Often enough, they're really just gestural laws which repeat what's already on the books but in a new packaging, which don't make any difference to sentencing, or at least don't make any difference except after the person's finished the first 20 years of their sentence, then they'll find they'll get another 20 years, as if, you know, it makes a large amount of difference to incarcerate 60-year-olds until they're 80 rather than merely till they're 60. This kind of thing is kind of delivered rapidly through the kind of mechanism of populist political response, as if a new act passed is the appropriate retaliation for a heinous crime that makes the newspapers. The second story that I tell, and again condensing it very rapidly, is about how individuals and households and corporations and communities have adapted to crime in their daily life. And the new routines and the new avoidance behaviours that they've come up with. And here it's a story, in a way, of, you know, a whole new industry, the private security sector, private police in shopping malls and pretty much everywhere else on university campuses. Ever since the 1970s, there have been more private police employed than public police. Where we live and how we live, the development in the last generation, to an extent that people probably don't remember how it was before this, of ways of living that are secured and kind of fortified, so that the entry phone buildings, buildings with doormen, security alarms, neighbourhood watch. If you want to have a kind of a graph that shows this very vividly, what you should do is plot the number of people in prison from 1973 to the present, which is a kind of steep and continuing incline, and the number of gated communities open from 1973 to the present, which follows a similar kind of path. It's the largest single residential type of development and building now, and indeed in the UK it's become so too. So in a way the culture of control operates at both ends, excluding and incarcerating deviants, but also fortifying the lives and the dwellings of the well-to-do. Now these avoidance behaviours which emerge, you know, go all the way down to things like where we go, what we consider safe, how we supervise our children, how we let them, as it were, move around the suburbs and the streets. It was the case, I think, in 1974 in Britain. In 1974, 80% of 8-year-olds travelled to and from school on their own, 80% of them. By 1990, that number had been reduced to 8% of them. The sense that, you know, what you can allow your children to do has been utterly transformed in that time. Not, of course, just by crime, but also by traffic and also by where people live and also the kind of moving around social space, but precisely the same kinds of sense that we have to secure and chaperone and supervise because of the risks of how we now live is precisely what it is I'm trying to describe. Now, just to conclude, these fears and irritations and routine avoidances and habits of thought and, you know, taken for granted fears eventually crystallize into a kind of institutionalized culture. So that even when crime begins to be less pressing and violent crime is reduced and the kind of adaptive situational crime prevention measures begin to be effective and there really is less crime around, in a way it doesn't matter to the social arrangements because they've been institutionalized. They now exist in real estate categories, where it is you can get a loan, where you can't get a loan, where you should live, where you shouldn't live, where's safe, where's not safe. They now exist in insurance contracts, what you have to do to qualify for a discount, what kind of security you have to have before your house is properly secured, and so on. There's a kind of crime consciousness that's built into our routines, our built environment, our imagination. And what I think that's done, especially for the groups who, as it were, are least at risk but are most responsive to any risk, namely upper middle classes, what used to be described as liberal elites and professional middle classes, they, I think, have been the key shifting factor in the politics of punishment because they themselves, for a long time, were the bastions of support for a kind of welfare approach to crime and delinquency. They were the ones who supported the whole social work, social engineering, transformations of delinquency and improvements of communities that were for a while the politics of this country. The fact that they did not protest, they didn't prevent, in fact they quietly encouraged the shift of the Labour Party into the crime control business or the Democrats into New Democrats into crime control business is, I think, a key shift here. And what one's seen as a consequence is that both parties, Republicans and Democrats, Conservatives and Labour in both places, have, as it were, become a bipartisan competition to outdo each other in terms of the politics of punishing and being tough on crime. So the basic conclusion that I draw is that these two stories, the governmental story of adapting to crime and the story of cultural adaptations in civil societies, are really interwoven. The political response, the punitiveness, but also the development of preventative measures, is in a way grounded in and only made possible by the habits of mind and action, as well as the anxieties and resentments that have become a standard feature of how people live crime in this period. So to that extent, the story I want to tell is not just about a political response, although it's certainly that, but also about a cultural adaptation in which the culture of control is not just how the criminal justice system operates, but also in a way how we ourselves live our lives in the face of these changes. Thank you very much. Yes, and then yes.
You describe this as happening nationwide. Do you have ideas about the geographical areas of our nation? I kind of feel Wisconsin the way it is. Wisconsin has done exactly what you described. I don't know about Minnesota. I don't know what
It's clear that there's enormous variation in the state-by-state patterns of adaptation, indeed state-by-state patterns of crime and insecurity as experienced and as recorded. It is the case that on most of these measures, the tendency, the direction, the trajectory has been the same state-by-state. You know, the difference between a sort of Texas response and Minnesota response kind of describes the variation. But the pattern of both of these places has been in the same direction. If you look at things like the sentencing laws, Minnesota has always been held out as the state with the best kind of forms of sentencing guidelines and so on, concerned to manage prison population, and places like Texas much less so. But actually they've all developed in precisely the same directions. So there is variation, there is intensity, and you know, I'm only scratching the surface of 30 years worth of complicated changes in policies and shifts back and forward. But my sense is that the overall tendency is the one I'm describing, and it's been there are few places, you know, rural, suburban, or urban, or inner city, that have escaped this kind of development, and local authorities have been responsive in pretty much these ways. So, you know, my answer is it does vary. There are important variations, there are resistances and counter-development, but the overall tendency in 30 years has been for most of the places to go in this direction. You had a question.
A lot of what you were talking about referred to violent crimes and poverty crimes, but in this country you have large numbers of those that are incarcerated, are in prison because of drug-related crimes,
sure,
which are really then often, very often, victimless crimes. And they are very often along racial lines.
Right. The thing is that in the perception of crime and fear of crime today, there's no such thing as a victimless crime. That's a category that doesn't exist anymore in this kind of perception. What I mean by that is that the community is affected by the presence within its streets, next to its schools, in its neighborhoods of drug dealing. That's the first thing. That's the perception I'm describing. Secondly, if there were no connection between drug use and drug sale and crime, then this would be less explicable than it actually is. The interrelation between poverty, drug use, and criminal behavior is the kind of key nexus here. It is the case. I mean, people regret it, and people now think that the laws that developed as a consequence were altogether disproportionate. But it is the case that minority neighborhoods have themselves often been the primary source of demand for more policing, more enforcement, and actually more removal of this problem from the neighborhood. So it isn't as if, you know, the drug crime is a doctor quietly doing heroin every day and functioning in their daily lives and never having to do anything more than dip into their savings. It's not as if it's about two students, you know, exchanging marijuana and still getting on with their studies. There's a perception, and there is a reality too, of the kind of interconnection between certain forms of drug use and certain forms of crime, and indeed certain forms of violence. The crack cocaine epidemic is the epitome of, you know, the toxic combination of drugs and money and guns and youth in minority neighborhoods, typically, with huge consequences for the sense of safety of anybody passing by, as well as the individuals involved themselves. So while I entirely agree with you that the war on drugs is as legislated and as enforced is a war on minorities and was seen to be such right from the beginning, insofar as the decision to, as it were, deal with street level dealing and possession was always going to make people vulnerable who were on the streets and didn't have private places to take refuge in. Nevertheless, I don't think that drug and drug use have no connection, no real connection to crime and violence. I think that there, you know, there's an important interconnection there that people often sidestep by envisaging that the issue as being a harmless one, a victimless one. You know, would that were entirely true.